You can hear Marcel ringing the bell. Super. Okay, so now's the traditional Q&A, where you can ask whatever questions you want. I'm happy to report we have now three microphones. I've got three children and three microphones, so there's a nice symmetry there. If you want to ask a question, just put up your hand, and they'll bring one of the microphones to you. So who wants to ask the first question? If you want to quickly say your name and where you're from, that'd be great.
Hi, I'm Lauritz from Frankfurt, and I would be interested in your takes on talking to management, because I think...
On talking to management.
Because I think normally, like, a lot of value investors seem to not want to do that to preserve their potential biases. And right now, after this perfect example on stage, I'm even more convinced that I am biased and not as able to make an objective decision as, you know, a lot of CEOs and founders are really charismatic and know their business really well, and I don't at the beginning. So how do you handle your biases and how do you judge that?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for asking this question, because it's one I feel really passionate about, and where, like you indicate, there's a lot of disagreement in the investment management community about it. So, you know, a lot of investors say, you know, don't speak to management because they're great salespeople, they're going to influence you, and you're going to lose your objectivity. It's best just to focus on the annual reports and what have you. And that's the sort of the perspective of investors. When you speak to business people, though, you get a very different perspective. Business people will always tell you it's always about the people. You know, you have to find the right people, and then, you know, that's a venture either works or it doesn't, depending on the who the people are. And, you know, I just couldn't agree more. And how on earth are you going to judge whether you've got good people or not without actually meeting with them? So, you know, I think it's hugely important. And, you know, one of the drawbacks you point to, I'm not even sure it's a drawback. So there's this sort of idea that you should be objective. But, you know, one of the most important skills or qualities of a CEO is they have to be likable, right? If you're charging out of the trenches and saying, you know, follow me, you know, people have to like you. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to work. And what better way to judge whether you like someone than by just saying, oh, do I like this person? And it's an incredibly powerful thing. There's all kinds of, you know, liking someone is a very visceral reaction, but there's so much sort of stuff happening in the unconscious when you do that. You're noticing, you know, it sort of subsumes into how they handle themselves. Are they show-offs? Are they humble? How do they treat other people? And all this stuff is sort of happening in your mind, and you probably don't really notice it. But at the end, you have this sort of impression: do I like this person or not? And, you know, so I think it's incredibly powerful. It can, like anything, there's upsides and downsides. So it can, of course, lead you astray. If you like someone who turns out not to be a good person, then that could potentially lead you to making an investment mistake. But there's lots of ways to make investment mistakes. You can misjudge the size of the market. You can misjudge the competitive advantages. So, but we still try and make a judgment on those things. And so why is this question of management, why is that something where people decide they don't want to make a judgment? So for me, it doesn't make sense. While the microphone is coming to you, I'll wanted to say at the beginning, feel free to, if you want to push back on any of my answers or ask for a clarification, that's totally okay. I had the great fortune a couple of years ago, shortly before COVID actually, to have a dinner with Charlie Munger, which was definitely a lifetime highlight. But one of the things which was a bit of a shame was it was a bit like a sort of a mini Berkshire Hathaway, where you would ask a question and Charlie would respond, and then sort of the next question came along. And so I'm happy for this to be as interactive as you like. So yeah, please fire away.
Yeah, great. I'm happy to push back. my take would be, don't you measure the same factor twice then? Because if I look at the company right now, I'm convinced it's a great business model, it's a great company, that is great returns. But doesn't the great management also already show up in the runway and in the financials? How do I differentiate that?
Yeah, So it's important to distinguish between outputs and inputs. So the output is always like the financial success. Is the business growing? Are the employees happy and being retained? Is the business making money and stuff? But that's an output. That's not an input. And what I would argue is probably the single biggest input is not just the CEO, but the senior management team, the culture, the way the employees interact with each other. And, you know, remember, as investors, we're trying to figure out outcomes before they're clear. So, you know, the financials are the scoreboard at the end of the day, which will tell us, has the investment been a good one or not? But to score goals on the scoreboard, you need to properly judge the inputs.
Okay. One last thing. When do you decide to talk to management in your investment process, so in your research process about a company?
Pretty early on. So I think, if you want to have credibility with the management, it's important to have a decent understanding of the business. I think any management would be very disappointed if someone shows up and the first question is, you know, oh, what does Trupanion do? I think there's other people that can explain that Trupanion is a pet insurance company without taking up CEO time for that. So I think it's important to have formed a good opinion on the company before and learned about it and stuff. But once you've done that, I want to get to the CEO actually pretty quickly, because I know that's going to be a really important point in the research. And if I see early on that the CEO drives a Ferrari and treats people badly and has a huge ego, then I'd rather find that out early in the process so I can move on to something else rather than right at the end of the process.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So who'd like to ask the next question?
Thank you, Tommy. Hi, Rob. Thanks for having us. My name is Andrea. I'm from Milan. I am an investor in the Business Owner Fund since 2016. So my question would be on the Business Owner Fund. If it's not too open-ended, would you want to give us a little bit of an update on sort of the key things that maybe changed in how you see your company since you have, last updated us on that, maybe just highlighting things that were your judgment sort of improved on the companies or where you see them less favorably, and I can narrow it down more if best to open-ended. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Andrea, and for the question. I don't think, obviously share prices move very rapidly and react to news and that kind of stuff on a day-to-day basis, but I don't think generally my opinion on companies really moves on a week-to-week or a month-to-month basis. Especially the last 3 or 4 months, I think some of the companies have had setbacks. So Facebook as one example, was hit by the, some of the Apple changes, some other factors, and that still a great business, it's still growing, still making a lot of money, but for sure there was a minor disappointment there, and I think that's been the case with some of the other businesses as well, but it hasn't fundamentally changed my opinion on any of these businesses. If I invest in something, then it's because I think it's a great business run by good people at a reasonable valuation, and I can be a shareholder for a really long time. And when I make an investment, I know there's always going to be setbacks. You know, there's no company is ever going to grow in a straight line. Sometimes they're going to have positive surprises. Sometimes they're going to have negative surprises. And it feels like the last few months, the negative surprises have been more predominant than the positive ones. But nothing has really happened to change my opinion on any of the companies there. They're all doing fine. Thanks. If you want to give an indication if you plan to ask a question, because we've got 3 microphones and then there won't be too much of a pause between each question. And there's one at the front here as well.
Hi, Rob.
Hi.
Thanks for organizing all this. My name is Ludovico. I'm from Milan as well. May I ask you what's your opinion on the macro situation we are living in? So what's your opinion on inflation, on interest rates, and so how do you think that will affect margin, if you think we will have wage inflation in Europe, some general comments on this. Thanks.
Value investors like me typically don't spend too much time thinking about macro stuff, simply because the one thing you learn through investing is that nobody can predict it. You know, nobody saw COVID coming. Nobody saw the Ukraine war coming, or not many people did. But the one thing you do know is that things are always going to happen. So I think the correct way to invest is to buy companies which are sufficiently solid, you know, have a sufficiently solving a sufficiently important problem for their customers that pretty much irrespective of what happens, they're going to do fine, because you know, that's you know things are going to happen. And you know, actually, I was speaking to Daryl about this in the car yesterday, and he made a great comment, which is, you know, if there was any piece of news that changed your opinion on a company, why would you even be invested in it in the first place? I mean, you know, I thought that was a great way of putting it. You know, one thing, you know, you mentioned inflation and rising interest rates, and one thing that is clear is, you know, interest rates and inflation go up and down. They were very low for far longer than anybody expected, and now they're certainly on the rise. Whether that remains the case, who knows? But you certainly don't want to be caught. Don't want to be caught out if you know, inflation takes off or interest rates take off. And you know, the Warren Buffett wrote about inflation in one of his letters many decades ago, and you know, he made the point that the very best type of investment in an inflationary environment is a company which is capital light. So it's a company that doesn't require to reinvest in capital to grow, and which has a lot of pricing power, because then they can just raise prices. So inflation goes up 6%, the price of the product goes up 6%. So it's basically a wash. And if I look at the companies in the portfolio, I think they're all very well set up to do very well in an inflationary environment. I think they're also would do well in a non-inflationary environment. So I can be quite agnostic about it. You know, the one thing I would say is, you know, the increase in inflation expectations and interest rates over the last few months has sort of coincided with, you know, really a panic in a lot of sort of the type of company that I think is best suited to prosper in an inflationary environment. You know, if I look at, for example, one of the companies in our portfolio, Wix, you know, it's a subscription business. It provides a service, you know, building websites for small businesses, which, you know, they really need. You can't switch off the website just because the, you know, prices have gone up 5% or whatever. I think that's a business which will do really, really well in an inflationary environment. And, you know, but that's a business, well, the share price has sort of suffered, presumably because people take a different view to that. But, you know, I think that's exactly the type of business you want to own in an inflationary environment. Yeah.
Hi, thanks Rob for giving us your time. Your answer about, Michael, by the way, from London, your answer about the management and was really fresh and unique, and it's so great to hear. And it kind of forced me to ask you this question. If you can give some detail, while being specific about a specific company, but you can give us some detail about when you take a loss in an investment, so you've realized that it probably isn't working out, and at some point you say, okay, hand up, I've made a mistake. Can you just walk us through how that works in your mind, please?
Yeah, yeah. So the question is on sort of when to sell, and you know, I really think the best sell decisions I've made over the last 15 odd years or so are the ones where I thought there was a fundamental problem with the company, and where I had to hold my hand up and say, listen, I misjudged this company in terms of its competitive advantage, the motivation of the management, the size of the opportunity, whatever it was, but where I felt I'd sort of misjudged that and sold, that was generally a really good decision. You know, to pick an example, I was in, shortly after I invested in Google, I think this was around 2011, 2012, I invested in Baidu, which is the sort of Chinese search engine. And one of the things I sort of realized after owning Baidu for a few years was that the search quality was very poor. And, you know, they were effectively mixing ads with organic search results. So instead of showing people the best result, they were showing effectively an ad. And, you know, that's something which destroys customer trust. And, you know, that was a reason I sold the company. And, you know, I've certainly never regretted that since. And I think it was a good decision. At the other end of the extreme, there's been cases of companies which I thought were doing everything right. It was playing out exactly as I thought. But at the time, it felt like the share price had gone up so much that it was no longer a good value. And whenever I sold under those circumstances, what generally happened was the business did way better than I expected, and I really regretted selling it afterwards. And there's been several of those. So for me, the biggest takeaway is, you know, the best time to sell a company is if the company isn't on track. And you know, with valuation or, you know, the kind of the short-term multiples of earnings and those kind of things, to be quite careful if that's the only reason to sell something.
Can I just follow that up?
Yeah,
sorry,
sure.
Sorry. So obviously everyone wants to sell when, you know, it reaches intrinsic value. But at certain times, certain valuations make more sense. And there are times when, for example, in the case of Baidu, like how long does it, like, is it a year? How long does it take to say, okay, it probably isn't working out the way I thought in my mind it was going to work out?
Yeah, oftentimes it's something that dawns on you over time. You know, if once you're invested in something, it's normally because you're enthusiastic about it, and it normally takes a little bit of more than one data point to really change your mind. So it is something that sort of tends to evolve over time, as opposed to being a sudden decision, at least in my case. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, first of all, Mr. Rob, for having us here. It's a pleasure. I'm Jonas from Germany. I have three questions.
Do you mind just asking one so everyone has a chance, and then you're welcome to get back in the queue?
Two?
you drive a hard bargain.
Okay, you make it two. And I think there's an interesting one. So the first one is, looking at Peter Lynch and Nick Sleep, after roughly 12, 13 years, I gave back the money because I said, I learned enough, I did it all, I climbed the peak. Would you see yourself at some point giving the money back, giving your record at the time you already spent on the game? And the second, the most important questions, and the one I'm actually more interested in, fear of failure. Many people would like to start
fear of failure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. People would like to start a company, a fund, to invest. How do you deal with that issue? If you pick a stock, if you look at your returns, and the indirect pressure of having the savings of people you need to invest, how do you deal and cope with that? Thank you.
Yeah. So on the first one, I would answer at a high level. It's really, really difficult to get started as a fund manager. That's the topic we're going to talk about tomorrow. If you're lucky enough to be that small percentage of people that actually gets to start a fund, it's really, really difficult then to build a good track record. Most people don't beat the market. And then, if you then build a good track record, it's really, really hard not for the fund to, you know, to drift into mediocrity or you know. I guess what I'm saying is there's ways you can fail at every point. You never sort of get to a point where, okay, it's done, it's successful. And, you know, at a high level in terms of how this ends, I'm really keen not to screw that bit up either. So it will be thoughtful, it will be planned very well in advance, and it will, of course, be in collaboration with my investors. But there's really sort of two routes it can go down. It could be that that I sort of point out that at some point in the future, Daryl mentioned 2035, or, you know, certainly very long time from today, that gets defined as a point where the fund will close, and that will happen in a very orderly way. But there's also an alternative where, you know, certainly my family's money and a lot of the other families who've trusted their money with me, their problem of where to invest the money isn't solved just because I go away. And so, you know, we need to figure out what the best solution for them is. So perhaps there could be some form of continuity. But the focus will be on making sure that having hopefully negotiated the start and the middle part of being a fund manager, that that the final bit works well as well. And the second question was sort of fear of failure. Yeah. I mean, that's a really big question. I think sometimes one of my questions my wife asks me is, you know, all this sort of money you're managing, how do you kind of sleep at night? And I'm always, you know, Charlie Munger talks about how you should always invert a question. And, you know, I try to use that type of fear or whatever it might be to my advantage. And, you know, I want to sleep well at night. And so I try to use that as an incentive to buy the type of companies that allow me to sleep at night. And if there's an opportunity where I suddenly feel that I'm not sleeping well, then maybe that's a pretty good indicator I shouldn't be owning it. So, you know, I think a lot of things you can really, I think emotions are very much a natural part of investing. There's this sort of school of thought with the sort of behavioral finance guys that the ideal investor should be objective and rational, and emotions are just going to get you into trouble and do things wrong. And I'm not sure that's the right approach, actually. I think it's unrealistic that you're going to keep emotions out of investing. And like I say, I don't think it's desirable. I think your emotional response to things can be very helpful. If you're not sleeping well at night because of you own a stock, well, maybe that tells you something. If you aren't looking forward to meeting the CEO of a company because you think they're an asshole, that's probably also telling you something. So I much prefer the approach of acknowledging your emotions, accepting them, and trying to turn them to your advantage rather than trying to sort of blend them out.
Thank you.
Did that answer your question? Great. Thank you.
Hi. So I'm Joan Esteve. I'm a fund manager from Barcelona. And I have two questions, but you can skip one if you think you don't have time. The first one is...
I'll choose the easy one.
What are your thoughts on the metaverse as a whole and as an investment, since one of your companies is investing in it, and it will probably be or is expecting it to be a flow of income in the future?
Yeah.
And the second question is about Wix. What do you think about the mention that they mentioned that they will stop giving guidance?
Which company, sir?
Wix.
Wix. Mm-hmm.
That they say they will stop giving guidance because they are thinking the moment it's very difficult for them to see the evolution or how is it what are the trends while it is a subscription company.
Yeah.
So just these two questions.
Yeah, thank you. And the first question, just remind me.
Yes, what are your thoughts on the metaverse as a whole and as an investment?
Yeah. So let's start with the metaverse, which is obviously, Facebook, which is one of our investments, recently renamed itself to Meta. And, the metaverse is a big focus for them. So it reminds me a lot. So one of the, in the late 90s, one of the things maybe people don't know is I was a telecoms analyst. Very pleasant period of my life when I was living in Frankfurt. And in the late 90s, there was this incredible boom with mobile phones. Mobile phone penetration went from almost nothing to, effectively, over 100% over time. And then around about the time, around the turn of the millennium, there was sort of all of a sudden this talk that, it looked like sort of mobile phone penetration. It was getting close to 100%, so obviously it couldn't really grow any further. But then this new excitement started about the mobile internet. The first 3G, these UMTS licenses were sold, and there was a lot of optimism that, people would be using the internet with their phones. And it was a fascinating period because there was a debate at the time whether anybody needed the mobile internet. And closely connected to that debate was, what is the app that people are going to use, or is there an app that people are going to use? So, me and everybody else were trying to figure out, what is the app going to be that, or is there even going to be an app? And you know, fast forward to 20 years today, and it's not like there's one app. There's millions of apps, and there's, you know, tens, if not hundreds, of incredibly important ones. So, you know, the sort of the forecast back then was, you know, is there going to even be one? And of course, what it turned out was there were millions. So, which is a long way of saying, I think that's a good way to think about the metaverse. It feels like we're where we were in the late 90s, and we're sort of trying to figure out, is there even a use for this stuff? Is it going to be something? My strong guess is it will be a thing, but it will be a thing in ways which we can't really know about today. But it will be interesting to see how that plays out over time. And did you want me to talk about Facebook as well and their investments in that area, or was it really just related to the metaverse?
What were your thoughts on Meta as an investment? I think it's a kind of future investment.
Yeah, so Facebook or Meta is an incredibly profitable company. They have about $50 billion of operating income. And included in that $50 billion is about $10 billion in of investment of losses effectively into the metaverse. And you know, the background of that is for all its strength as a company, one of the things Facebook suffers from is that the operating systems are controlled by two other companies, you know, Apple and Google, and for mobile phones. And so I think so they don't want to miss out on whatever the next platform is, and so they're going to invest in that. I personally think it's too early to be spending as much money as they are on it. I mean, $10 billion is a lot of money. I mean, if that was revenue, that would be one of the largest companies in the world, and that's just cost. At a time when you don't really know what the metaverse is going to look like, I think it's too much. But on the other hand, you know, Facebook has a value as a company of around $600 billion, and it's run by a great entrepreneur who's very rational. If in 3 or 4 years' time it's nothing, then it will be $40 billion of losses, which will then go away. So a meaningful number, but not really in the context of Facebook. And if it is something big, then, you know, fortunately they have invested it in the forefront. So I view it as an option as an investor. If the Facebook valuation was super high and it needed the metaverse to work to make sense of the investment, I would for sure not own the company. But the share price is so unbelievably low, the valuation is so unbelievably cheap, it just doesn't really move the needle in that respect. I mean, it's really incredible. I mean, if you take away the cash on its balance sheet, Meta is close to about a $500 billion dollars market cap. And if you add back the losses that they're making into the metaverse, it's close to $50 billion in net income. You know, so you're paying a 10 times earnings for one of the all-time great companies. And then people, you know, talk about tech companies not being attractive because interest rates are going up. Well, doesn't make sense to me. But we'll see how it turns out. And then on Wix, I mean, I guess it's not necessarily specific to Wix, but I would just say for those of you who aren't familiar, Wix is a company that regularly provides quite detailed guidance to investors on what they expect for the coming quarter and for the coming year. And there's obviously a degree of uncertainty at the moment, as sort of they benefited a lot from COVID, people staying at home, building websites, and now kind of people are slowly going back into the real world. Led to a slowdown in their business, obviously a greater degree of uncertainty, as a result of which they've decided not to provide guidance anymore. I'm personally not a fan of guidance. I think there's a lot of companies that get into a lot of trouble by providing guidance. I recently read a book about GE called Lights Out, which was a great read. I can recommend it to everyone. And at the core of GE's problems was effectively this guidance that Jack Welch gave over decades, that they would grow 20% every quarter, and it just led to effectively fraudulent behavior. So I'm not a fan of guidance at all. And if it was up to me, I would advise all of my companies not to provide it. But if you're going to provide guidance, then you can't just stop when it suits you. So if they decide on an ongoing basis not to provide guidance, then that's fine by me. If they decide they want to to continue doing it, and then they should be consequent and continue doing it. So that would be my message to management. But I'm actually going to Israel next week to visit with them, so I'll pass that message on to them. So where's the next one?
Hey, it's David Herman from based in London.
And I have put your hand up. I can't see.
Yeah,
here. There you go.
I'm just in front. So I just have a question on Carvana. If you could kind of, actually, it's kind of an industry question. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at the UK car dealership industry, and they've kind of increased margins similar to the US a lot due to the supply chain issues, and it's kind of set to continue. So my first question would be, what do you think? Will we reach a point that there's basically no more cars to sell? And a second question would be with economic sentiment that, which is kind of the lowest since the global financial crisis, do you think that could have an impact on consumer spending and potentially on cars? I probably know your answer to that one already, but
Yeah, I mean, if you're investing in a business for a long term, you don't really worry if, you know, consumer sentiment sometimes goes down and sometimes goes up, but you can't base an investment decision around that. If you decide you believe in where a business is going for the long term, then you expect there to be good periods and bad periods. So that's certainly not something I would pay too much attention to. You know, maybe for those of you who aren't familiar with it, Carvana is an online seller of used cars in the US. A lot of sectors, as we all know, have moved online over the last decades, you know, starting with Amazon and books and lots of other e-commerce things. But used cars is actually the one thing that is still mostly sold offline. I think the penetration of online cars is 1-2%, so similar to pet insurance. But it's a vastly superior experience for customers. You don't have the hassle of going into a dealership, haggling with a salesperson, having this fear of getting ripped off. With Carvana, you just can surf on the internet, choose a car, click a button, and in a best case scenario, the car is delivered to you on the very next day. And you know, I think in the US, there's roughly 40 million used cars sold per year. And Carvana this last year sold around 400,000. There's a really, really long runway to go. And you know, I think there's no reason why the online penetration couldn't be 10, 20, 30% or even higher in the long run. So, you know, that's the reason we're invested. You know, as you pointed out in your question, there's a lot of disruption to the used car market at the moment. So that comes from a disruption originally from the new car market. So when COVID hit back in March 2020 and it looked like unemployment was going to go up into the stratosphere and new car sales were kind of collapsing, and all of the car companies phoned up TSMC, which is the main company in the world that makes semiconductors, and canceled their orders because they didn't think they were going to need them. And then, you know, what happened was actually the world economy bounced very quickly back from COVID, and because of the importance, because people were less keen on being in public transport because of Corona and everything. Actually, the demand for new cars went up, which is not normally what would happen in a recession. So all of a sudden, you had an increase in demand. At the same time, the supply was falling. So there's less new cars being made than usual. And the impact of that is people who would typically buy a new car are now buying a used car. So it's creating a squeeze in the market, and the prices are going up, and all kinds of crazy stuff is happening. But you know, I really don't think that impacts our investment in Carvana in any kind of a meaningful way. You know, there's, like I say, 40 million used cars sold per year in the US. 400K of those are with Carvana. So even if the market were to contract, then you know, there's still plenty left for them to do. And you know, in terms of, obviously, there's going to be a lot of price volatility with used car prices jumping, and presumably at some point they're going to come back down again. But you know, Carvana, like most car dealers, actually they turn the inventory very quickly. You know, when they buy a car, they typically sell it within about 6 weeks. So you might have a very short-term impact where, when prices come down, they take a loss on or less profit, more likely on some of the cars they have in inventory. But then they start buying new used cars at the lower price, and that kind of washes its way through. And actually, in general, I think it will be good for the used car industry when prices come down, as that will stimulate demand. So, so overall, I think it's not a problem, and it's not really central to the way I think about the investment.
Thank you. Perhaps like one follow up on EVs. Because kind of there is a question like with EVs that it's a lot about batteries, and if the battery only lasts like 10 years, there won't be a used car sale. How do you think that plays into the equation? Because in some sense, I think the transition probably boosts used car sales because there's not enough maybe infrastructure for those EVs. But then like later on with EVs, when they take over, do you think that would still be the right investment?
Yeah, so you know, there'd be a used car market for EVs in the same way there's a used car market for combustion engine cars. So I don't think it will change the size of the market. You know, I think one of the questions that I had was to what extent, you know, Carvana, one of its key competitive advantages, it has a lot of capacity to recondition cars. And, you know, to the extent, you know, electrical cars require far less maintenance than combustion engine ones. It's, you know, so I, one of the questions I had was to what extent that could negatively impact Carvana's business. But from what I understand, Carvana doesn't sort of do sort of mechanical work around the engine or anything like that. They sort of repaint the car, take out the dings, make sure it's clean inside. It's the kind of stuff that you'd have to do for an electric car as well.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Rob? Yeah, this is Paolo from Milan.
Oh, Paolo, hi.
There you are. Following up on Carvana, I would like to ask a question about the direct competitor in the US, which is CarMax. Probably when you studied Carvana, you also looked at CarMax, I assume.
Yeah.
And CarMax now also has the online channel.
Yeah.
So I was wondering why, at the end of the day, you decided on Carvana rather than, for example, CarMax. Also, obviously, you saw some advantage on Carvana versus CarMax, and I would like to understand that.
Yeah, I think I did. I mean, at a high level, I admire CarMax enormously, and you know, CarMax sells about 1 million used cars a year versus 400K at Carvana versus 40 million in the whole of the US. And you know, so there's plenty of market for both companies, and I think both can be successful without the other having to fail. But that doesn't answer your question of why Carvana versus CarMax. And, you know, I think the really big opportunity in used cars is online. You know, online is, you know, next to nothing penetration today, and over time we'll be far bigger. And to me, you know, and I guess some CarMax investors might say, well, CarMax is perfectly positioned for that. If you want to buy the car in store, they have stores. And if you want to buy a car online, they have an online place, so they can serve both constituencies. But in my view, that's not the way it works, because if that was the way it works, you know, department stores would have, you know, been the big successes in online and not Amazon. You know, you would have said, well, in the department store, if you want to buy the good in store, you can just go in store. And if, you know, they have online shops, and if you want to buy online, you can buy it online. And of course, that's not the way it works, because for online, you require completely different infrastructure and cost structure than you do for offline. For offline, you have expensive real estate in well-situated locations. You have lots of qualified salespeople running around. You have a logistics infrastructure that can bring inventory into all your little stores dotted around the place. And that's really just a completely different setup to what you have online. Online, you have a smaller number of very large fulfillment centers and a hub and spoke network to deliver the packages or the cars, whatever it is to customers. And the last thing you want is the expense of holding inventory in lots of different locations, of paying rent, of having salespeople standing around idly. So in my view, it makes sense if you're focused on online to have a pure online strategy. And if you're focused on offline, to have a focus on offline. Trying to combine the two, I don't see any synergies in that.
Hello, this is Orlando from Portugal. How are you?
Hi, Orlando.
Question about holding, I'm going to mispronounce this, but Grenke, is mm-hmm. it?
Yeah.
I was just curious if the events of the past couple of years have changed your views of the company and the management, given the audit process and, you know, although nothing, there was no wrongdoing, there were some weaknesses in internal controls, and the complexity is quite... it's quite high. Thank you.
Yeah, so for those of you who aren't familiar with it, Grenke is one of the longest holdings in the fund. It's a small ticket IT leasing company, which is based in Germany. And, for small businesses that want to buy a photocopier or some laptops or whatever it might be, they have the choice of paying in cash. And if they don't want to pay in cash, they can get a lease from Grenke, for example. And it's a wonderful business that it grown very well over many, many years. And then 2 years ago, two things happened. So the first was COVID hit, and that led to a decline in some of their sales volumes. It also led to them being more restrictive in giving out new loans. So obviously, there was an expectation of higher levels of bankruptcy, which materialized. So that sort of hurt the business. And then just when it seemed like they were sort of coming to terms with that, in October of 2020, there was a sort of a 40-page short report about the company claiming that the company was a fraud, that its customers didn't exist, that the cash didn't exist on its balance sheet, and all kinds of sensational claims, I would say. And it came hard on the heels of the Wirecard scandal in Germany, where effectively, regulators had been asleep at the wheel, while Wirecard, which really was a fraud, ended up collapsing. And, regulators were keen to show, okay, we're not going to screw up a second time. And so they've really been putting the company through the ringer over the last, 18 months or whatever. Multiple companies have been inside the company, testing all kinds of things, commissioning reports, basically going through the company from A to Z. And, what's come out of that is that there was almost no substance whatsoever to the claims of the short seller. To give you a sense of how absurd they were, one of the claims was that the company's cash didn't exist. And, within a week, the company said, well, as it happens, we keep our cash at the Bundesbank. So that was, just a very obvious, point they could disprove. So on the one hand, but your question was, has it changed my mind about the company?
Yeah.
And, on the one hand, as I say, I don't think there was any substance to the criticisms leveled at the company. But on the other hand, I have to acknowledge that the business has suffered a lot from the combination of COVID plus all the disruption created by the special audits and responding to these criticisms and stuff. And so, unfortunately, the business today is a smaller business than it was 2 years ago, and a smaller business is a less valuable business. So it's, from the perspective of 2-3 years ago, it's been a poor investment. From the perspective of since the beginning of 15 years ago, whenever it was, it's still been a great investment. But the business has suffered. I think in this situation, it's easy to blame the other guy. But every company at some point in time is going to have a short attack on it. I think almost every company I've ever invested in has had a short attack on it at some point or the other. And you have to have the substance to withstand that. I think there was some bad luck in the way it sort of coincided with this Wirecard scandal a few weeks before. I don't think investors who blame their bad investments on luck or things like that are going to be successful investments. So I just have to accept that that's from the perspective of 3 years ago was not a great investment.
Just if I may follow up, but given that it's still on your fact sheet, you still own it, and the stock price has come down a lot. So as a prospective investment, is the price more than adjusted for the sort of destruction value because of the scandal?
Yeah, I think in hindsight, when this sort of whole attack came on, my instincts were protective towards the company. I found the criticisms made against it disgusting, and under that situation, I wanted to show loyalty to the company. And that's actually something I don't regret. But you know, having seen, and you know, at some point it was visible that the business was really being damaged by this. You know, the company's management spent basically 18 months doing nothing else but respond to audit requests. You could see the business going down. You know, at some point, probably the right thing to have done would have been to have sold, but that was an opportunity I missed. And seen through today's perspective, I really think the valuation is crazy again. You know, it's trading, the stock is trading around book value. I think it's on a, you know, potentially if earnings get back to their previous level, which I think they will, it's, you know, it's on a single digit PE, you know, for a really good company, which could grow. So from today's perspective, it's definitely not something I'm planning on selling as of today, but you know, I would probably see that a little bit differently if I could sort of dial the clock back 2 years.
Thank you.
Hi, Rob. Hi. Akash from London. My question is about Wix and stock-based compensation. Mm-hmm. And we'd spoken about this briefly around 2 years ago, where it's a great tool to attract talent, but it's also a real expense. And around that, 2 years ago, maybe it was 10% of revenues. And I think you had mentioned with scale, you should see maybe that percentage going down.
Yeah.
Over the last 2 years, that's sort of gone up maybe to 17% or so. So just your thoughts on that. And secondly, I guess with the stock price coming lower, how do you think that plays into attracting and retaining talent? Because I guess it's an important piece of motivating employees.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so obviously as a long-term investor in a company, I don't like to see dilution. I prefer the opposite, actually, where companies are repurchasing their shares, so my stake in the company gets bigger over time. But the reality of tech companies, and especially younger tech companies, is the major motivating factor for young, talented people to go and work there is the prospect of, you know, stock-based compensation and the, you know, the additional upside that can come from participating in the company if it becomes really successful. So I don't think you have a really choice on that. But the way I kind of think about it is, you know, when a company does mature, you know, stock-based compensation will also normalize. And, you know, and I think you've seen that in a lot of the old, you know, the first or second generation of tech companies. So I remember when I first invested in Google, you know, there was a lot of concern about stock-based compensation and dilution and stuff. And, you know, of course, as the company has matured, you know, that's sort of normalized, and you see that at other companies. So the bet would be that that over time that does normalize. But that's an important point because obviously, if your stake in the company is being diluted by say 5% every year, then the earnings power needs to grow by 5% just to kind of just to break even. And then in terms of kind of the decline in the share price and what that means in terms of employee motivation, you know, fortunately, you know, this hasn't happened in a vacuum. Pretty much the entire tech sector has really declined very rapidly in price. You don't necessarily see it in, when you look at the NASDAQ. You know, the NASDAQ is very heavy in large cap companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft and stuff like that. So the NASDAQ looks comparably stable. But if you look under the surface, I saw a statistic recently that over 40% of the companies in NASDAQ have lost over 50% of their market value this year. Or not this year, from the highs, I think. So it's pretty dramatic. And it's happening under the surface. But it's sort of, fortunately, it's happening to Wix's competitors as well. So while that's the case, I think that's that should help them.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. My main question is about assessing management teams. How much does their stock ownership factor into that? I think as investors, we often take comfort in seeing founder owners in the management team, but I've sometimes wondered if it's a lazy proxy. And related to that is, you know, there's plenty of management teams that own a lot of stock, but also sell a lot of stock. And while they're trumpeting the company and talk about how cheap the stock is, and, you know, I think sometimes Carvana, others can come to mind in that category, but there's plenty of examples. Given management integrity is one of the main kind of tenets that we all have, you have, does that kind of call put an asterisk on it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I called the fund business owner. And one of the reasons the fund is called that is because I really try to align myself with business owners. You know, so one of the biggest criteria before I make an investment in a company is making sure that, you know, there's some kind of founder or major shareholder there who, you know, who's presumably well aligned with me because he or she is also a big owner in the company. So in an ideal situation, I like to see the CEO as the founder or the major shareholder. It's not always the case though, but where it's not the case, I always look for there being some major shareholder who's also kind of involved in the company, you know, so they're engaged, and that's part of the kind of the research process to make sure that that's the case. No, but it's really something I think is super important that I also look for. In terms of sales, pretty much, you know, every company I can think of, the CEO sells stock periodically, and it's not something I have a problem with, and I've never found it to be an indicator of there being problems around the corner or anything like that. Normally what they sell is a small part of their overall stake. And, you know, the reality is, you know, people have priorities, you know, boats in the case of Daryl, maybe houses or whatever it might be. And, you know, I think it's understandable that having built something of value that, you know, at some point they want to sell part of their stake and use the money to buy something else. Yeah. So. One on the back there.
Thanks, Rob. Regarding Carvana, what's your take on their latest acquisition? As it may have, as they increase the debt and therefore maybe the risk profile in a time when it's like a capital, a working capital intensive business and they are not generating cash flow.
Yeah, so Carvana announced an acquisition a few weeks ago of ADESA. And ADESA is a company that runs physical auctions for used cars in the US. So the way the market typically works is dealers purchase cars at wholesale auctions to put on their lot, and then they get sold from the lot, obviously, to the retail customer. And Carvana bought this business. It's a nice business, a mature, probably modestly declining business, but with a decent amount of cash flow. But really, the main motivation to buy it was, as you can imagine, it's an old business. So they have these auction sites dotted all over the U.S. I imagine in very good locations, probably out of town locations 50 years ago, but probably, you know, given the way cities have grown, probably much more central locations today. And these locations have a lot of excess land on them. And Carvana's plan is to build, you know, IRCs, so inspection and reconditioning centers on these plots, and use that as a way to build out its network. It strikes me as a really, really smart thing to do, which will accelerate its footprint. You know, as anyone's ever built anything knows, it's really difficult to get approvals to get something built, and there's always lots of opposition and stuff. And these are plots of land which are already approved for used cars and stuff. So I think it will help them to get to where they want to go more quickly. Now, as you mentioned, as a business, it's not profitable at the moment. It's investing a lot because it's, you know, obviously wants to grow very rapidly. And the way it financed this acquisition was with debt. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of debt at all. Most of the companies I own have net cash. To the extent they're a lending business, then they would typically have debt, as there's no choice, but they would have less debt than most of their competitors. So it's not something that I'm a fan of. But, you know, the way I think about it is, you know, in two ways. Firstly, the debt is held against sort of like physical assets, so real estate in the case of the ADESA acquisition and used cars, which are very liquid assets effectively. So it's very low risk debt from the perspective of the lender. And the second thing is, you know, if you look at the shareholder base of Kavana, it's very, it's a very wealthy shareholder base. The Garcia family is very wealthy, and a lot of its investors. Were the company to need capital, it would be no problem to put capital in. So, from my perspective, I don't view the indebtedness as being overly risky. But if I had a choice, I'd prefer it wasn't the case. But there's actually one situation where I've seen in the past, which is actually the exact opposite of this. So in Germany, there's this company called Beiersdorf, which is the owner of the Nivea brand. So, you know, the skincare, which I'm sure everybody is familiar with. And Beiersdorf about 40% of the shares belong to one family. And what they do is, the family have borrowed, I don't know what the numbers are now, this was a few years ago, but they had, call it 5 billion of debt privately. And they held 5 billion of cash in Beiersdorf against that. So if ever they had a problem servicing that debt, they could just simply take the capital out of Beiersdorf to service it. And from the perspective of a Beiersdorf shareholder, it kind of sucks because they're getting all the juicy returns from the investments they're making, and then you're stuck with this cash, which is, you know, at the time it was yielding zero. Over recent years, it's probably had a negative return. So I wasn't super keen on that either. And in a way, I'm not a guy who particularly likes leverage, like I say, but in a way, it's actually quite an interesting situation with Carvana that you get to kind of piggyback on this leverage in a non-recourse way. If it works, the returns will be way better than they would have been. But if it doesn't, you can always just kick in a bit more equity. So it's I have mixed feelings about it, but it's I could see some upside to it as well.
Hi, Rob. Yep. Steph from Zurich.
Hi, Steph.
Hi. My question relates to Salesforce and Slack, given you were a Slack owner before Salesforce acquired it.
Yeah.
And the question would be, how do you see the Slack acquisition by Salesforce, and how do you continually track its progress? And maybe related to that, the second question would be, what do you see as main risks in the Salesforce investment?
Yeah, thank you. So we were invested in Slack a couple of years ago. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's kind of like a WhatsApp, but for business to business. It's a messaging tool for businesses. It was an incredibly successful company, which was growing primarily virally. So obviously any messaging service, the more people who are on it, the more value it has to you. So it would sort of grow sort of virally just by people passing it on to each other. But I think they sort of hit a wall at some point where they needed, if you want to penetrate the larger companies, then you have to have an enterprise sales force team who can sort of go and, you know, speak to the management and convince them of how good your product is. And so I think they hit a bit of a wall, and that was around the time that Salesforce.com bought Slack. This was probably about 18 months ago now. And I thought it was an incredibly smart decision because it gave Slack what it was missing, which was an enterprise sales team. And from Salesforce's perspective, you know, Salesforce, as I'm sure many of you are aware, is a sort of an enterprise software company with lots of different software modules, primarily, for the process of selling stuff in a company. And what Salesforce was lacking, though, was sort of something to kind of tie all those individual modules together. And I think that's what Slack brings to them. So I think it was an incredibly smart decision. And at the time, the market was very, very pessimistic about it. So I think the day Salesforce announced it was going to purchase Slack, the share price was down, 15, 20% or something like that. And so that was really, Salesforce is a company I followed for many years. But that was the moment where I started sort of focusing on it as a potential investment. And, I think Salesforce is a great company. I think the Slack acquisition makes a lot of sense. And, as I had the cash coming in from the sale of Slack to Salesforce, I basically use those funds to invest into Salesforce.com. And in terms of tracking how Slack does, you know, I think Slack's really, it has this enormous opportunity to become effectively like the WhatsApp for business. And if it achieves that, it could be, you know, Slack alone, I think, could be worth as much as Salesforce.com is today. I think it has a great chance of achieving that through the combination of its own viral growth plus the very powerful Salesforce that Salesforce.com has. So it will be super interesting to see how that goes, and probably the key metric to follow is how the users are growing and, you know, how the revenue is growing at Slack.
Okay, Stefan Wurmbacher from Hamburg, in the middle. Hey.
Hi, Stefan.
Hi. You talked earlier about your decisions to sell, and the good ones are when you lose, your thesis doesn't work out anymore. So I'm just wondering, from a practical point of view, you're also, once in a while, you're also getting excited about a new opportunity, and yeah, you have a concentrated portfolio. How in practice do you free up capital for the new opportunities when you, you know, how do you time that with your sales?
Yeah, I mean, there does seem to be a sort of a natural ebb and flow to that. You know, over time, there's normally one or two companies that I'm less enthusiastic about in the portfolio, and they might either be sold down quickly or slowly over time. And you know, normally around that time, there's something else I'm getting interested in. So it tends to happen quite organically. You know, what I've also benefited from, I think, over the years is there's always been a steady flow of cash into the fund. You know, one of the easiest ways to buy new opportunities has generally been to just deploy that cash into a new opportunity. So I would say that's how it's sort of generally happened, yeah. But there tends to be a natural flow to these things.
Hi, my name's Alan, and I'm from, and I've come from London. So I wanted to ask, I had a question.
Sorry, whereabouts are you from? I didn't catch it.
Sorry, my name's Alan, and I've come from London.
London, okay.
And I had a question about Salesforce. So one can argue that generally there's been an increase in the number of firms providing similar or the exact same software in both the developed world and the emerging world. So potentially, do you believe that this can commoditize the sector Salesforce operates in, and essentially create negative pressure on the future earnings potential of the company in the long run?
Yeah. No, I mean, the really important thing to understand, I think, is that Salesforce is really like an operating business for companies. You know, there's companies that build their entire business around Salesforce.com. It's so tightly integrated into all their processes, all their data and stuff. It's almost impossible to imagine a scenario where it gets ripped out. You know, so in short, it's not something that I worry about. I mean, the one thing you do see is, you know, what I just said refers obviously to large established businesses, but there's obviously a lot of newly established businesses, and for them, that argument doesn't count. And so you have a lot of lighter CRM solutions, easier to use, cheaper as well. And for a smaller company, probably it's more natural for them to then gravitate towards one of those type of solutions. You know, so I think there will be there is competition in that part of the market. But even there, what I've spoken in the past to venture capitalists, and what you hear is that at some point, when the business gets to scale, they're going to want to switch to Salesforce at any point. And so, you know, the ambitious companies which are really being built for scale oftentimes, you know, start out with Salesforce so they don't have to switch later on. So it's almost like an industry standard, I would say. It's really difficult to imagine anyone really sort of disrupting it. But there is competition certainly at the low end for sort of small and medium-sized businesses.
Hey, Rob, over in the Peanut Gallery. I'm going to give you a few questions off the internet.
Oh, great.
Thanks, I'll read too. Who they came from. This first one comes from Luke Skywalker. For real. the question's on Chinese ADRs and process in particular. Just how has your point of view changed with the developments over the last couple of months?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there has been any developments over the last couple of months. I mean, so Prosus is our investment. It's a South African company. Actually moved to Netherlands, but it's originally a South African company. And they, 20 years ago made a large investment in Tencent. At a time, Tencent was a tiny company. And, fast forward 20 odd years to today, and Tencent is one of the largest companies in the world and probably the single most important company in China. Prosus has virtually never sold any of its shares, so still owns 29% of Tencent. And that stake alone is worth about 100 and, I think I wrote it down here, let me just check what it was. The Tencent stake alone is worth about 115 billion euros. And Prosus's market cap is 70 billion, and in addition, it has a whole bunch of other stuff as well. So, I think it's a valuation which is totally crazy. But the question is, of course, always, well, there must be some reason for that, and the share price has done very poorly the last few weeks. And I think one of the reasons given is that there's an increased nervosity about the robustness of ownership rights in China, especially given sort of everything that's happening in Russia. And I don't want to. Well, we can go down that rabbit hole if we want to, but I really view Russia and China as very, very different things. I know from the perspective of someone based in the US or Europe, who's never been to either Russia or China, and both seem to be vaguely sort of previously communist and with autocratic sort of leaders, it can feel like it's sort of more or less the same type of thing. But if you've spent any time in China in particular, the two countries couldn't be more different in my view. The Russia is effectively a mafia state, in my view. I think that's been clear to people for many years, and it's obviously very sadly been shown to be the case over the events of the last few weeks. Putin has done nothing for his people. There's, the company hasn't developed in any way. The life expectancy of males has declined. You have a small minority of hugely wealthy people. But that wealth has come from effectively stealing state assets as opposed to creating businesses. I saw one idiotic comment comparing Russian oligarchs to Jeff Bezos. And Jeff Bezos created one of the greatest businesses the world has ever seen that creates value for everyone on this planet. I mean, it just the difference to a Russian oligarch just couldn't be more different. And then you compare that to China, and I think China is the opposite to that in almost every respect. It was a struggling third world country 40 years ago, and it's risen now to being, it's on track to become the largest economy in the world. And it's been an incredible development of human potential. Hundreds of millions of people moved from poverty on the countryside into cities. Incredible companies created, incredible increases in wealth. It really, really couldn't be more different in my view. And so if, the questioner is sort of implying, look what's happened to Russia, China is next, then that's just a hypothesis which I just don't agree with. It kind of reminds me in my very first job, which I don't like to talk about too much. I had a sort of stint in London at Goldman Sachs Asset Management, which I hated and not particularly proud of. But I was there for about a year, and one of the reasons it was such an unpleasant job was, the guy who was effectively the boss of the business at the time, he wasn't particularly competent or particularly competent guy. And it kind of captured it, and we were always, of course, laughing at him when he wasn't there. And it kind of captured it once. We had this Japanese businessman visiting the office, and it was a problem because this guy, this Japanese guy didn't speak any English, and none of us spoke Japanese. And my boss back then said, That's not a problem. Why don't you take Christophe? Now, Christophe was a guy in the office who was from France, but spoke excellent English as well. So he, you know, by English standards, he was like close to a genius in terms of languages. But we're like, yeah, why would we take Christophe? And he goes, well, he speaks foreign. And I kind of feel like when people effectively throw China and Russia in the same bucket, I kind of feel like it's like they're making a similar mistake. But I realize not everyone will agree with that, but that's the way I see it.
All right, next one from the internet. Marcel Schober, this question is on moats. Can you talk about how the different sources of moats and how that point of view has changed over time?
Yeah, it's changed a lot over time. You know, so there's this, you know, one of the, you know, if I think about my journey as an investor, when I started out, I was very much focused on balance sheets and numbers and that kind of stuff. And actually, I sort of started investing properly around the time of the dot-com crash. And, you know, at the time of the dot-com crash, a lot of the companies lost sort of 95, 98% of their value. And in some cases, you know, they had more cash on the balance sheet than the actual value of the company. So as a sort of a rookie investor, know-nothing investor, but if a company had 100 million in cash and it was, you could be buying it or a stake in it for 10 million, that kind of looked to me like a very good deal. So that's kind of how I started investing. And then after a while, I sort of noticed sometimes it was working really well, but other times it wasn't working at all well. And one of the reasons it wasn't working well was when the company had a sort of no competitive advantage, and even though it had a lot of cash, it was losing so much money, in the end, it kind of went to zero. And so quite early on in my investing career, I kind of started focusing really a lot on competitive advantage. And you know, when you start thinking about competitive advantage, then you come across Warren Buffett, and he's obviously talked a lot about how important it is that companies have moats and this type of thing. And so I would say it's something that I was focused a lot on. But two things have really sort of changed my mind about it. The first is I don't think all moats are created equal. So I think some moats are very positive for a business. You know, for example, if you have a low-cost position, I think that's fantastic. You know, Daryl described it about Trupanion earlier, the lower the costs are, the better the value you can offer to the customer, which allows you to lower costs even further. So it's a very positive type of a competitive advantage. But there's other moats, for example, switching cost, which where the idea is the customer is so locked in to the company that you can basically give them a crappy service, raise prices, and you know whatever happens, they basically don't have any choice, they have to stick with you. And I think that's a kind of like a very negative moat, because it sort of incentivizes you to do a bad job. And if you're doing a bad job, then at some point in time, the business is gonna deteriorate. So I think that was the that was really sort of one of the first sort of insights I had about it. And then the second one I had was that I kind of realized that the world is changing so fast that by far the most important thing to look for in a company is that it has an ability to adapt, that it's sort of permanently improving itself and you know, figuring out what the new challenges are, what the competition are doing, what the new services customers want, and like, you know, responding to that and developing the business. And in the big scheme of things, is a moat, if a company with a wide moat, is it more or less likely to you know, to have that sort of sensitivity to customer requirements? And you know, I think on average, if the moat is really, really wide, then the companies generally become complacent and fat and, you know, less focused on what the customer wants. So I don't think a moat is always an unmitigated good. So what I, and I wrote about this in my most recent letter, what I much prefer to see is a company which is improving so rapidly that, you know, moats are kind of emerging from that, but where the moat is really kind of the output. And so it's kind of nice to have, but what you're really looking for is the input, that sort of constant improvement, because that's what's going to drive the really long-term success.
Thanks. Last question from the ether. This is from Vianney. It's on diversification. So Charlie Munger says that three stocks is adequate diversification. What's your latest thinking on appropriate diversification, and how has that changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, I have like a very non-scientific approach to diversification, which is that you know, I've always had around 10 stocks in the portfolio, and there's nothing scientific about that. I know if I have too many stocks, then I'm just going to replicate the index, and if I have too few, if they run into problems, then I'm potentially going to lose all the money. So I want to be sort of somewhere in between those two extremes, and I've always felt, you know, 10 is very much on the safe side, because if you've got 10 stocks and one were to go to zero, which I hope wouldn't happen, but theoretically could, then you'd still have 90% of the money left, which seems like a level you could easily recover from. I think it could be easily less than 10, but I just view that as my sort of margin of safety. I'd rather sort of be on the safe side than have too few, but three probably works out fine, especially if the companies are quite sort of diversified and have different businesses. So if you think of like a Berkshire Hathaway or an Amazon, in many respects, they're one business, but they're one business which contains lots of different businesses within them. So three would probably work, but why take the risk? Thanks for the questions from the ether. Actually, Tillman told me earlier on that the live stream didn't work for the first session, which my initial reaction was obviously disappointment, because I know a lot of people wanted to see that. But I think it's about time. I think it's time that the people in the real world got some revenge on the virtual world. But I'm glad to see the live stream is working again now, and I hope there's a few people in. Yeah, and Tilma said the first session was recorded, so it will be uploaded, and so that will be available at some point. Yeah. What else have we got? Okay.
Hi, this is Monik from Boston. So one of the things that I spend time thinking about is, when you invest in, you know, 8-10 companies, sometimes you're living with contradictions in your portfolio, especially with the management teams. And I see in your portfolio, you'll own Salesforce, which has a unique management culture, or you'll own Credit Acceptance Corp, that has a very different culture. And so how do you sort of reconcile and think about, is this the right management for the right company?
Sorry, were you saying you see contradictions in the portfolio, or just different types of
just different styles? Yeah, different companies, yeah. And yeah, how do you sort of make sense of all that?
Yeah, I mean, like, there's lots of different types of great management. I mean, what you're looking for primarily is sort of authenticity, and you know, oftentimes, you know, I think the best managers are like their skill set is uniquely suited to the company, and the company uniquely needs their skill set. And that's often because that manager is the founder, and so the company to a certain extent is a reflection of their personality. And I always used to think, you know, there was a time a few years ago where Yahoo was doing, you know, far worse than Google, you know, still is obviously. But, you know, it wouldn't have helped if Larry Page had, you know, suddenly gone to Yahoo. I mean, that would have been a complete disaster. And of course, Marissa Mayer didn't have much luck there. I mean, you know, Larry Page was uniquely successful in that particular environment. And that's obviously not a coincidence, because he created that environment. So it depends on the situation. And if I look at the management teams, like you point out, you know, some of them just couldn't be more different. If I think of the Credit Acceptance guys, who I just couldn't think more highly of, they're very introverted, straight shooters, tell it like it is. Rarely, if they respond to a question, it rarely goes beyond one sentence, and that one sentence rarely goes beyond 10 words. And so, like, very understated, but very precise. And then you have kind of Mark Benioff at the other end of the extreme, who's like this larger than life personality. On the conference calls, the first 10 minutes are taken up with how wonderful his team are, and how wonderful the world is, and how totally great everything is, and how everyone's a genius. And I mean, it's just, it couldn't be more different. And I mean, personally, I prefer the understated guys to that, but you can kind of see how, in the case of Salesforce, that it works, because, you know, as the name suggests, Salesforce is a company that is about selling things. And, you know, he's obviously a great salesperson to not just his customers, but to his employees. You know, the ratings that employees give to the company are just completely off the charts. So, it really is dependent. And it's why I don't think you can have like a set idea of what constitutes a great management. It's very sort of situation specific. You know, one of the criticisms I sometimes see from value investors is they don't like it if a CEO is too much of a showman or too sort of salesy. And but you know, I think like we touched upon earlier, if you know, the job of a CEO is to lead, to make people enthusiastic, to want them, make them want to follow. So I think that's not necessarily a bad trait to have, having that sort of ability to get people to follow you, to be able to sell to people, especially if it's a selling company. So and the other end of the stream is oftentimes when a charismatic leader steps down, it's the CFO who takes over. You know, CFOs are kind of numbers guys. They tend to be kind of very understated, very into the details, into the nuts and bolts of the business. But then and investors respond to that because they speak their language. But it's not always great for the company, actually. You're never going to get, any sort of, you know, that's not necessarily the type of person that can motivate employees, who can make bold decisions to go into new areas or to close businesses down and that kind of stuff. So it's very situation specific. Yeah. One right at the back.
Hi, Rob.
Just before you start, I think we've got about 5 minutes left, so probably time for two or three more questions.
Hi, Rob. Arnaldo here from Italy. I'm just curious, how long have you been investing for yourself before the fund? And were you investing before your working experience, and how you approached changed from investing for yourself from investing money from other people?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So that's really how I learned to invest, was just simply investing my own money. I sort of caught the investing bug in the dot-com crash, just when, you know, there was just an incredible period to be investing because things were so so cheap. And it was a lot of fun intellectually. It's also a lot of fun when you're making investment decisions and then making money. And so it's sort of like I really loved it. And ever since then, I've sort of been investing my own money and constantly trying to learn about investing and get better and that kind of stuff. And in 2004, I moved to Switzerland and started working for this sort of family office based in Tessin. And the family office was sort of run by this sort of very sort of patriarchal, sort of octogenarian Italian guy. And he sort of called the shots. He said, you know what you have to do. And I didn't really like it. You know, I was sort of enjoying investing my own money, and I hated like someone else being the decision maker. And so this is sort of getting a little bit onto the topic of tomorrow. But, you know, I really wanted to be the one making investment decisions. And so that's why I set off and did my own company. And I was incredibly fortunate that the way RV Capital got started was my first client was a guy called Norman Rentrop, who's a publisher based in Bonn. And he was the one who provided the seed financing for the Business Owner Fund when it started in 2008. And the one thing he said to me when the fund started is like, do whatever you want, but just don't change. Just keep doing things exactly the same way. And that was great for me to hear, because, you know, I didn't know any other way to do things than the way I'd managed my own money. And he not only tolerated that, but he encouraged it. And so, you know, since then, I've really never looked back. And I think I've managed to dodge a lot of the mistakes that the investment industry makes. And it wasn't because I was smart enough to see they were mistakes and make an active decision not to do them. It was simply because I just didn't know how industry worked. I mean, I'd never really been in it. I'd only been managing my own money, and so it was a great way to start. Yeah. Thanks for the question. Ah, Dennis.
Thanks, Rob. Really enjoyed this meeting. Thank you for getting us all together. It's really special. Thank you.
Thank you for getting so many people together last night. Dennis said he planned to hold a little dinner for about 10 people and mushroomed to 60 or something. So thank you for that.
And thank you for all for joining and for the patience. And something I kind of threw together, literally threw a wedding reception in 2 days. Anyways, Rob, thank you again for this incredible gathering. I have a question just as a fellow fund manager. How do you think about qualifying investors into your own fund? Are there certain characteristics that make an ideal business owner fund investor?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of fell into this by accident rather than by plan. But when the fund started, I kind of thought, now I'm a fund manager, I better go out and try and find some clients. And of course, when you're like a very small fund with, you know, at the time I had less than 10 million assets under management, zero track record, zero reputation because I'd only been managing my own money at that point, of course, no one wants to invest with you. So I would like sometimes travel, you know, like spend a whole day traveling somewhere to pitch to someone to invest in me. And then, you know, after like having wasted a whole day on this, they would say, oh, sorry, we can't invest because you have to have a 10-year track record. I'm like, did I have to like lose a whole day first to figure that out? So I kind of like threw my toys out of the pram. I'm like, I hate this. This makes no sense. I'm not doing it. And just focused really on the investing side of things. And then a sort of like an interesting thing started happening that every now and again, someone would reach out to me and to see whether they could invest with me. And it wasn't despite the fact that I was small and unknown and with only 10 million assets under management, it was because of that. You know, otherwise, they wouldn't have reached out. And so I kind of stumbled on it really by accident that there's this incredible, powerful tool, which is just to allow the right people to find you. Now, it's a lot slower doing things that way. If you to look at the assets under management of the business owner fund, a lot of funds, they kind of do this and then they kind of hit sort of like the jackpot and then the assets do that. If you look at the business owner fund, it was really very, very straight and still is actually to this day. So it's slower, and this gets a little bit into the topic of tomorrow. But I think it creates a much better investor base, and you just have to make sure your cost base is adapted to that situation. So if you hire like five analysts and fancy offices and all that kind of stuff, you're going to be in trouble if the assets don't start coming in. So then you're kind of forced to go out and find people. But if you have the patience to let the right people find you and a cost structure that fits to that, then it's worked really well for me.
Are there any characteristics of investors you accepted into the fund that you later regretted accepting in? And are there characteristics or qualities of that type of investor that you sort of take away as a heuristic?
Well, it's actually quite tough to invest in the fund as everyone who's invested knows. So fortunately, there's really I can honestly say we've never had an investor in the fund who I've regretted coming in. That's I have wonderful relationships with all of the investors. There's never been an angry word spoken between us, and it's really been a very fulfilling aspect of managing the fund. What I have done though is taken meetings that I've regretted. So for example, I have a policy that I never speak with intermediaries. I only ever want people who are managing either their own money or if it's an endowment or whatever. But I want people making their own decision, and I want to have that direct relationship with them. I don't want like a some kind of salesperson or private banker or that kind of person as an intermediary. But one time I took this meeting with this sort of intermediary against my better judgment, and it was a great meeting. They really understood everything I was saying, and I thought, wow, this is turning out way better than I expected. And then right at the end of the meeting, they said, we can't invest in your fund, but we have this pool of capital which we could put into a new vehicle, but we would like take a cut out of it. So they basically were proposing some kind of a structure where they were going to like take some of their customer funds for themselves. They were like, Rob, what have you done? So meeting finished and lesson learned.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dennis. I think we've got time for one last question.
I'll take it if I can.
Yeah.
Back in the back. So I'm Tim from Hamburg, one of your investors who ran through this process, made it.
It's not easy, right?
It's not easy, no. But it's worth it. And now I have a question to one of your long-term holdings, Ryman Healthcare in New Zealand, which has a great, I think, tailwind from the demographics. And I was wondering how you think about, because it has two sort of businesses. You got the care business, and then you got the real estate development business. which is pretty much dependent also on the interest rates environment, which is probably increasing a bit, and also the real estate market, which is also dependent, obviously, on how, you know, interest rates are going to move. So I was wondering, what's your view on the perspective on that, and you know, will Raimund still be able to, you know, even if the interest rate would increase tremendously, be able to still set the prices?
Yeah, well, it's great to have a question on Raimund. It's probably my one of my favorite companies in the world, if not the favorite, and it's because they just they have the most incredible mission that I've ever come across. I mean, we were talking about Trupanion earlier, and I think care of pets is a pretty important mission. But Raimund's mission is taking care of mom and dad when they can no longer take care of themselves. So they build and operate retirement villages, and it's a business which across the world is completely dysfunctional. You know, the story of the retirement industry is that after the Second World War, there was a sort of new prosperity in the West, and, you know, previously when old people got old, you know, probably they weren't taken particularly good care of. But in this sort of new prosperity, hospitals were being built, and of course old people then being taken into hospitals when they were when they couldn't take care of themselves. But That didn't work because they weren't getting better. They weren't going to get better. They were, you know, approaching end of life. So they couldn't stay in the hospital. It was too expensive. They had to go somewhere else. So what effectively has happened all over the world is you have these sort of institutions that get built, which are kind of like a hospital in that they take care of the physical well-being of the person, you know, so assuming it's well run, it's sort of clean, there's a nurse on hand if you have a problem, the room is taken care of, you get changed, you know, all of the kind of the physical needs are well taken care of. But nothing is done to make life enjoyable and worth living. There's nothing done for the spiritual side of life. And that's why anyone with an older relation, probably everyone here, knows that the very last thing an old person wants to do is to go into a retirement home, because they know that's basically game over. So they kind of push it to the very last possible minute when they've had like the 10th fall and, you know, when it's basically the end, and then they go in and they've more or less given up already and typically will die quite soon afterwards. And Raimund has sort of taken this sort of paradigm and created a sort of like a Disney type experience in their villages, where the villages are fun places, where there's a lot of love, where there's a lot of friendship, where there's a lot of things happening. And it's just, I mean, if you visit one of these villages, it's one of the most moving experiences you can imagine. So I think it's one of the most incredible businesses I've ever come across. And, you know, your question was about interest rates. you know, obviously there's a need for old people to be taken care of. I mean, it's probably one of the single biggest unmet needs in our society today. So irrespective of what inflation does, interest rates do or whatever, this is a business which I think will be doing very well. But as it happens, I think it's actually also exceptionally well suited to inflation and high interest rates, because, you know, I mentioned earlier on that the best type of business to own is a capital light business in an inflationary scenario. Now you might think, Raimund doesn't sound very capital light. It builds these huge villages. They cost billions of New Zealand dollars to build. But the super interesting thing is, once they're built, Raimund retains ownership of the village, but sells an occupation right to the resident. So the resident pays money to Raimund, and in return gets the right to stay in the village for however long they need to. So basically, Raimund participates from any appreciation in the value of that asset. In fact, that's one of its main sources of earnings, but doesn't carry the capital. The resident carries the capital. So I think it's an ideal business for an inflationary scenario. Great. I can't believe how quickly time has gone by. It's already it's well after 12, so I'm sure Nate is chomping at the bit to get out onto the slopes. I don't want to keep you any longer. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you for your questions. Go enjoy the mountain, and we'll see you back here at 6 p.m.